It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See
terms and conditions. 18+. From Variety, I'm Michael Schneider.
The medical drama ER premiered in 1994 and quickly became a monster hit. The show ran for 15 seasons through 2009 and helped change TV storytelling as we know it. For The Handmaid's Tale showrunner Bruce Miller, it was also an inspiration as he embarked on a writing career.
I had graduated from college, and about 2 weeks after I graduated, I had moved out here to kind of try to become a writer, and then I figured I'd fail and go back and get a job like all my friends got. Yeah. I don't know what happened. Next thing I knew, I was here doing this podcast. But I was living in Los Angeles, and I remember the apartment we were living in. We had heard about the show, and in those days, it was funny because Michael Crichton was the most famous person attached to it. And I had watched and read The Andromeda Strain, and I had watched and read The Terminal Man, and all these kind of very high concept, future thinking sci-fi things. And then this show, I was expecting that. I was not expecting something as grounded as it was. But I remember watching the first one, and the thing that struck me because I was still trying to, definitely still trying to figure out how to write, was that you didn't know Carter's name till almost three quarters. You didn't know anybody's name. Or you didn't know who was connected to which name. They're talking about people. And the fact that you don't really need to, that's not information you need to know. Yeah. It really kind of turned my head around in terms of when you get to the end and you really feel like you've been through an experience, and then we started to talk about it and nobody remembered anybody's name. And so the things you're trying desperately to kind of pound into people's head, or I was at that time writing scripts, this is this person's name, this is what they do, you realize it doesn't matter. There was an interesting thing about a lot of my friends were going through that thing, being in medical school, because they had gone on to medical school after college, and so they were just finishing up medical school, becoming doctors, going into specialties. So it was really an age that I could relate to, and I think that means something. I mean, when you start to think about, oh, okay, a lot of my friends are becoming lawyers. Isn't that interesting to see what they do all day? Unfortunately, a lot of what happens on TV is you see exactly what they don't do all day because it's what, people imagine that they do.
So I'm Michael Schneider, and on this edition of the podcast, we talk to Bruce Miller about the pilot for ER, which is his favorite episode of TV ever, plus his favorite episode of The Handmaid's Tale. It's my favorite episode.
My favorite episode's about to start.
'Cause you're my favorite episode.
My favorite episode.
Coming real, it's the next episode. Episode.
Bruce Miller and his team on The Handmaid's Tale are busy at work on season 3 of the Hulu drama, which of course is based on the Margaret Atwood novel about a dystopian future in which the United States has been overthrown and replaced with a harsh theocratic kingdom known as Gilead. Elizabeth Moss stars as June, also known as Offred, and we follow her journey as she survives and powers through this new reality. The Handmaid's Tale made history last year as the first streaming series to win a Best Series Emmy, picking up gold for Outstanding Drama Series, as well as a statue for Moss as Outstanding Drama Actress, among 8 wins overall. This year, the show is aiming to repeat in those categories and more, picking up a whopping 20 nominations. IndieWire recently sat down with Miller to discuss the show's success and the pressure that comes with so much attention and Emmys in its first season. We began by discussing Miller's favorite episode of TV ever, the pilot to ER, a show that he ultimately worked on.
But just first of all, it's an impossible question for me. I mean, yeah. Most of the time, my favorite episode of television is the one I've seen most recently.
Yeah.
And there are certain iconic episodes of television that are so memorable, but not necessarily your favorite. You know, my first answer was Chuckles the Clown from Mary Tyler Moore.
Yeah, classic.
It was a classic. But you know, is it your favorite, or do you just remember it really well?
Yeah. And does it hold up? There's some that you remember that better than when you actually rewatch them. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as good as I remember it.
That's true. And I luckily had seen the pilot for ER when it aired. And then I saw it, you know, another time through the years. And then I worked on ER, so I watched it again just for kind of novelty's sake. I had, luckily, when you get on a show like ER and you're there in season 9 or 10 or 11, whenever I was there, you normally have to go back and watch all of those seasons to catch up.
Yeah.
But I had seen it all. So luckily, I did not have to go back, so I could pick and choose.
Yeah.
And one of the ones I watched was the pilot. And the things that struck me about it were, first of all, that it was so slow paced compared to the show now, or currently when I was there, and also how I knew that they had, when it first got picked up, they said it's way too fast paced,
right.
No one will be able to follow it. So that was very odd. But the thing that I noticed about it, and the thing that I was, over the years, I was always impressed at how good a pilot it is, because it doesn't ever feel like it's explaining anything. It's just on a run the whole time.
Yeah.
All the relationships are established on the run. I think the first line is Dr. Green gets woken up and they say, Dr. Green, you know, there's a patient. He says, tell, you know, Dr. George Clooney to, you know, Dr. Ross to take care of it. And she says, it is Dr. Ross.
Right.
So that's the beginning of the pilot. So you understand all of these dynamics, and you know another drunk has, you know, Dr. Ross has come in drunk and having hurt himself.
Right. Again.
Again. And so, but just, you know, the I'm trying to sleep at work and they're waking me up. And I mean, all of those elements are so great. So, you know, I loved ER, and I loved the kind of the pace of it and the way the visual style, and also the, you know, the acting was so grounded and realistic, and also all the props and all those kind of things. But it really was kind of over the years how well put together it was as a pilot.
Yeah,
which is such a tough trick.
People come in here and they're sick, dying, and bleeding, and they need our help. Helping them is more important than how we feel. But it's still a pain in the ass sometimes.
Yeah, what's interesting about the pilot, too, is that it's so it's titled 24 Hours. So it really is kind of just a snapshot of an entire day in the ER. So there's a lot of, like, mini stories going on, but there's no real, like, beginning, middle, and end narrative,
right.
Which, you know, now doesn't seem as revolutionary as it probably did back in 94, where, again, they were doing so many different things with this pilot that I'm sure at the time, and from what I remember at the time, network execs were like, we don't know what to do with this thing. It's too fast-paced. There's no real narrative.
There's too many characters. Too many stories to follow. Exactly. Yeah. You're right. And I think coming on the heels of I don't know all of the I'm certainly no television historian, but I think John Wells came out of the Bochco camp, and this was after Hill Street Blues.
Yeah.
And Hill Street Blues was just a revolutionary show for me as a writer, as a viewer, because there were so many storylines, and also they all didn't start at the beginning. They could start a storyline three quarters of the way through.
Yeah.
And the same thing on ER. And I think that, it was a good evolution for John Wells to take something that was in a situation like a police station where lots of stories do happen and they are, you know, uncomfortably unfinished a lot of the time, to go into an emergency room where it's exactly the same thing. You never know what's going to happen. You never know how it's going to resolve. And you also don't know how long it's going to last.
Yeah.
That something could... And so really that lesson taught me a lot about Handmaids, which is, if you lay out the story in the first scene, people are going to be bored. They're too good at predicting and they've seen too much drama.
Yeah.
So you just, you know, try to tell the story in the way the story is meant to be told. And if it happens to start two scenes before the end of the episode, start it there. Don't. And that was really the lesson from ER, that just tell the story. you can't start telling the story till they roll in the door. Mm-hmm. So just wait till they roll in the door and start telling the story.
Yeah. No, that's interesting because ER, of course, had like 22 or 24 episodes a year to have to tell all these stories.
Makes my stomach hurt even to hear you say that number. Yes.
Exactly. But the other funny thing about that pilot is, of course, we would never have ER if Jurassic Park wasn't a hit, right? The whole, like, origin story of Michael Crichton finding, like, dusting off an old 1970s script that took place in Boston, and he just changed the name of the city to Chicago and sent it in, and they managed to take this dusty old script and update it and make it contemporary.
And I think it was originally entitled... the emergency room is not what they call it because it's not a room. It's a floor of the hospital. It's a ward. And so in the old days, it was called the emergency room. Mm-hmm. But John Wells tells a story that when he first got the script, it was titled EW, which is emergency ward. And he said, no one's going to watch a show called EW.
Yeah.
And so we should probably change it. But the funny thing is now all emergency rooms are called ERs, but they weren't before ER. They were called the emergency ward or the emergency department or the ED is really what they call it.
Yeah.
So it's strange that TV show kind of took an old phrase and brought it back and actually cemented it on everybody calls the emergency room the ER.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the other famous thing, of course, from the pilot is the idea that Juliana Margulies' character was going to die. Famously, that was the original plan. And in some ways, they kind of just leave it hanging at the end of the pilot. Mm-hmm. But, and you hear about that from time to time. Actually, I was just at Comic-Con last week, and Vince Gilligan mentioned that they were going to kill Jesse off after season one of Breaking Bad. So this happens often. Where
we make terrible, terrible decisions and then try desperately, scratchily to spin around like a dog on a pavement and a slippery floor.
Yeah. And then, but it, sometimes it works. Sometimes you come back and you say, thank God we veered left.
But also thank God we told that story about them, because oftentimes the story at the beginning where they have a brush with death ends up, in Nurse Hathaway's case, the character on ER, kind of defining her for years and years and years and really making her a very interesting character. I think the lesson I always take from that is that when she... You said it's this great cliffhanger in the show, in ER, in the pilot, when Nurse Hathaway comes in and you don't know what's going to happen to her. And it seems simple, but the thing that always says to me is, this is the beginning of a series. This is the beginning of something, not the end of something. And so you feel like stories are either leading you up to an intriguing second story or cut off halfway through where this is an intriguing story. And it really does feel like... she did such an excellent job, Hathaway, or Juliana Margulies, and you wanted to know what that relationship was going to be like. And so you really feel like, oh, what I got out of it was a really interesting introduction to a character, but that story is still interesting to me. And I think once you watch the pilot, which is pretty long, I think it's 90 minutes.
Yeah.
You really get a sense of her and George Clooney together, and I think once you get that chemistry, you're kind of like, well, why would we? What are we going to go? What, who are we going to find that's better? What are we going to go out and look for somebody? But I've been on lots of shows where you kill off a character, or you think you're going to kill off a character in the pilot, and then once you watch it, you're like, I need that person. Why should I just replace them? Why don't I make them survive?
Yeah. And I imagine it's a combination of the actor just like pulling off an amazing performance, but also realizing, no, this character is key. And maybe there was a reason why you wanted to kill them off, because they're so interesting. That would have been the most shocking thing to do, was to kill off this great character.
Yes.
And stab yourself in the foot.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that... it is another lesson you learn from watching Bochco shows. A lot of times he doesn't kill people, he just sends them away. They go off to take it. Like most people disappear in your life, not because they unfortunately drop dead, but because they go off to do something else somewhere out of your orbit. And I always liked that in, shows like, Herskowitz and Zwick and Winnie Holtzman and where they wouldn't, killing a character. I always feel like killing a character is kind of, it's the end to something, and it's not really, people die in your world, but I don't know necessarily that people should die more in your world on TV.
Yeah.
It just starts to feel unusually heavy-handed.
And do you think, we've gone through so many years of these, sort of darker shows and shows that, used killing characters as a plot point, that the audience is a little more immune to it? It's harder to shock them now than maybe it was 10 years ago.
No, I think you're absolutely right. It's harder to surprise them. Yeah. I mean, I hear commentary on my show, and all they're doing is saying, okay, well, this person's probably going to die, this person's probably going to die, this person's probably going to die. And you understand that that's coming from a dramatic education, not from a world education. I don't think most people look around at the people in their lives and go, ah, this person's going to die, this person's going to die.
Right.
But they expect that kind of heightened drama. In a place like Gilead or in an emergency room, it's not so unusual to have people dying, so it makes a little bit more sense. But I, oftentimes, you're right, the character who is killed in the pilot is someone who has either been written as an interesting character or portrayed as an interesting character, and you made the right decision. They were essential to the pilot, and they'll be just as essential in the second episode, and you're just going to have to replace them with someone who gives you that vibe if you don't bring that person back.
Yeah. So take me back to 94. Where were you at the time? What were you up to?
Thanks for giving me the year. That helped. As I said, I came out here to write after I graduated from school, and I got a job in a bookstore, and I worked there for 10 months, and then I got a job writing. I don't know. I don't have any idea what people do for a living. I've never had another job.
Yeah.
So I am rudely and obsessively interested in what people do in their jobs. When I go to parties, I always want to corner the person who's like a marketing consultant and say, okay, what do you do? And they're well, I consult. You're like, no, what do you do?
Specific,
when you get into the office in the morning, what do? Well, I check my email. What's in your email? And so, because I don't, I know the same jobs that you and I knew in kindergarten, policeman, fireman, shopkeeper, I don't know any, And so I'm fascinated, and now I know a lot about those jobs. On this show, we do a lot of research, and we end up talking to people who work in these very difficult areas of non-governmental organizations, refugee settling, dealing with people who are the victims of horrible sexual violence, and they are inevitably, they have the darkest, most hilarious sense of humor.
Yeah.
And they make appalling jokes that you would never, ever make. But when you work in that business, that's what you get. And thing that I really felt in ER is I really understood not just this workplace, but what kind of people it attracts and what it does to them in terms of their sense of right and wrong and life and death, because they live in a different environment where those things are a lot more in balance.
Yeah.
In the balance.
Yeah, it's a world where your work is your life.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
as a writer, you probably can relate to that, right? I mean,
this is an
all-consuming job that you have. But
the funny thing about working in an emergency room, which is really kind of the same way the show covers it, is that it is all-consuming, but when you walk out, you don't have any patients to take care of. Every other doctor is getting reports on their post-op care or the baby or whatever. Those people walk out, and they have no idea what happened to those people. So it's all-consuming, and when you walk out, you have that feeling that an audience does, which is, what happened to those people? So there's kind of the audience and the doctors are in the same position of not really knowing the fate of the people they cared so deeply about for that 90 minutes.
Well, the other thing that I think people always talk about with ER is the fact that they didn't talk down to the audience, that they didn't explain the procedures. They just used the jargon but never explained what it was.
Yeah.
So you didn't quite know what they were doing, but it didn't matter. You were there in the experience. And I feel like that sort of helped TV evolve. And, it allowed other shows as well to do that and no longer have to speak down to and just – if the audience doesn't understand what's going on, they'll check it. And of course, nowadays you can just go on Google. But
yes.
And
100% clarity is not the goal. I mean, I think we're still learning that lesson because it's always difficult to look at a piece of art that you make and you sit down with your studio and network, and there are things that they don't understand. And what you do is you have to decide whether the explanation is going to be more damaging than that moment of not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And ER is a really good example. Part of that workplace is the fact that you don't know what they're talking about. So if it didn't have that, it wouldn't feel real. The great thing is that you can have two people arguing on ER about two different surgical techniques or two different diagnoses. And as an audience member, you don't have a clue who to back factually. You don't know if they're speaking Swedish. I mean, they might as well be arguing in Swedish. But you know who you like more. or what their dynamic is. So that's what you're kind of going on. So it ends up being a character and relationship moment, not a moment about whether we should do, you know, put in a chest tube or not, which I have no idea about.
Right.
And so what you end up doing when you work on that show and is just come up with the dynamic. You know, you and I are arguing over, you know, what you did to my ex-wife, and so let's just have that argument, have it take place over, you know, a patient and a suture kit and all this stuff. And what you just realize is that you can watch a movie in Swedish where two people are arguing and get the gist.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're arguing. You know what arguing is like. And so here it's the same thing. It's just a different language, and the language happens to be kind of their medical workplace language.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, what was your breakthrough job? What was your first big writing gig?
Probably my breakthrough job was working at a video store when I was in high school, because that's when I saw every single movie that I wanted to.
That was the education of Bruce Miller.
Definitely the education of Bruce Miller. And I'm sure a lot of people of my generation had the same education.
RIP video stores.
They were horrible and poorly run and enjoyable while they lasted.
Yeah.
They were a business model that you could smell failure. I worked in the first one in my town, and it was like, this is never going to work.
Right.
My first job as a TV writer was on a show called Higher Ground, which was on Fox Family, which was a network that existed briefly.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was Christian Hayden Christensen was in it.
Mm-hmm.
AJ Cook. It was a really good Megan Ory. It was a really good cast. They're still all working. I was a staff writer. It was a nice first job. And then I went into features for a while, and my second job was ER. Because after I'd been in features for a while, I hadn't really been looking for a TV job. And John Wells read a pilot that I wrote.
Yeah.
And he just asked me to come work. And I said, yes, sir. How high, sir?
Yeah, yeah. Especially at that point. I mean, nine years into ER, that was still the pinnacle.
And it was also... it was a show I enjoyed that I really understood. I loved the balance of character and storyline and all that stuff. And I love kind of the medicine. I love becoming a fake doctor. And, you know, it was wonderful. And I loved working with all those people. But I really have to say, they did a lot for me, more for me than I did for them. I didn't know what I was doing, really, as a producer, certainly, and as a writer. And, people like Scott Gemmel, and John Wells, and Yao-Lin Chang, who's here, and David Zabel kind of taught me how to write for TV because here I was, you know, sitting in their offices. But they were very patient, and sometime I'll pay them back for the 2 years I owe them.
I was going to say, how hard is it to join a show that far into its run when it's kind of, a well-oiled machine at that point? Is it... intimidating, or is it sort of, this is the bonanza? I hit the jackpot.
I think it's both. I mean, I think it's intimidating. Just, you know, you go into these rooms and you look around and it's like the Yankee bullpen. I mean, these are all the best writers you know. And especially at the beginning when you don't really quite understand what your role is going to be. That's at the beginning on every show and at the beginning of your career. You don't know what day-to-day is expected of you in the writer's room. So it's very intimidating, but I do have to say that there's – they are so excited to have new, fresh voices because, you know, whatever their situation, you know, they've been working together for a very long time and, you know, people get on each other's nerves. So they're always happy to have a new, fresh voice that is a fan of the show. So because of that, even though you come in with butterflies, they were so accepting and encouraging and that kind of thing. But the, you know, every show, I think, you know, even shows that are run really well, you know, it runs like a Swiss watch, and it runs like, you know, 300 chickens running in different directions. I mean, it's not never a well-oiled machine. There are elements of it, and John Wells was great at kind of taking elements and oiling them and making them work.
Yeah.
Even if they were kind of isolated, we had a really – but it's just – it is chaos because you're moving forward too quickly. You know, when you're making 22 episodes a year, you're moving forward at a breakneck pace.
Yeah.
You're filming really quickly. So all of those things kind of it's a question of managing the pace that it's moving at, the breakneck pace that it's moving at, and also trying to rush, trying to move quickly without rushing and move with urgency without panicking.
Yeah,
and that's what I really found that ER was like when I first got on it. But you know, I was in awe of all of those people, and I still am. Honestly, they were a great bunch of people. They're spectacular producers. Dee Johnson, you know, all these people. They've gone on to, you know, fame and fortune, and they deserve it.
Well, you know, this is always a hard question to kind of answer because I don't know if there's a concrete answer to, you know, lessons learned from, say, working under a John Wells that you apply to this day. As a showrunner, was there any sort of specific showrunner tip or style that you sort of took and ran with, and eventually when you were running your own show, was like this is a great way to do it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I stole liberally and directly from John Wells because I thought he did things so well. And after I left ER, you know, I was on a lot of other shows and, you know, didn't get brought back after a year. I mean, so you end up working with a lot of other showrunners.
Yeah.
And you get to compare and contrast. But from John Wells, John Wells used to delegate producing duties to his staff of producers, and then every week he'd have twice a week we'd have producers meetings where we'd sit around and go around and say, okay, you know, music, what's happening with music? You know, do we have our composer? What are we doing with this or that? Publicity, you know, we now do, you know, web and social media, you know, casting and those kinds. And so that organizational system, I lifted directly from him, and every show I've run, I've done it.
Yeah.
And we do it here.
Yeah.
I like it for a couple of reasons. First of all, John Wells, I think, was always interested in training the next generation of showrunners either on his show or on another show. And so you have to delegate for realsies. You actually have to give them stuff to do that you expect them to do. And if it doesn't get done by them, it doesn't get done.
Yeah.
And so I do that. And it's fantastic. It's the only way to do my job. But, you know, I have all these really smart people who are doing all of these time-consuming, thought-consuming things. Parts of the job, and it's the only way I'm able to kind of carve out enough time not just to do my job but to think. So that I took from him. The idea at the beginning of seasons, he always took a writer's retreat to go and kind of think overall about the season past and the season to come. He did his in Hawaii. I don't do that. You know, he did his in Kauai.
Yeah, yeah. Economics were different back then.
Economics were different, but it sounds lovely. But try to explain to your family that you're not on vacation when you go to get flown to Hawaii for a week, and all you're doing all day long is sitting in a room, and the ocean is about 150 feet away, and you sit there and work and watch the sun come up. And then watch the sun go down, and it's like tantalizing.
Yeah.
But regardless of the setting, so I use a much more, you know, much more workaday setting of my house, and that way no one is really, you know, getting their family very angry for coming to my house for the afternoon. And we sit and we go through the season past, and we make cards like, what was your favorite episode? What was your favorite character? What character do you think was most underused? And we sit down and go through all of those things as a group. Mm-hmm. And I think that you go over the past season, because I think sometimes for me, I'm so focused forward on what's going to come up next that you really don't take those lessons. And so that's what we try to do. So those two things I took from John. I mean, there's a million other things. I mean, Chris Chulak was running the show for a while when I was there. Jack Orman was running a show. John Wells was running the show for a while when I was there. I got to see all those different people run in that system. John just puts the executive and executive producer. He really, but the other thing I took from John was I could see how it seemed like he was so happy when he got in the writer's room to talk about story.
Yeah.
Because he had a lot of other big things going on, you know, big deals, big, you know, a big company to run. And it seemed like you could see just the light come on his eyes and see him relax and really enjoy himself. And so it made me realize, don't give that part up.
Right. Yeah. Because they always say, like, the showrunner is kind of the CEO of the operation. But as a result, there's so much more you have to worry about than just the writing. But that's what brought you to this business.
Yes,
that's what, like, you are, is a writer.
And that's all I'm good at. So.
That brings us to your favorite episode of Handmaids, and you mentioned episode one of season two.
Yes, I did. I mean, I really hesitate to mention my favorite episode.
They're all your babies.
Well, they're all my babies, and also I'm really proud of what we did kind of overall. I mean, you know, to make two seasons where I feel like, oh, okay, I this is two seasons and I like every episode and I pretty much every moment's the way I want it. Okay. So the hard, you know, the hard part is you try to turn them all into your favorite.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did. I mentioned season one of the, because there was a lot of, I had a lot of time to think about it.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad. But I got a chance to kind of tune it to an interesting pitch. And that's what I liked about it. You know, for coming into a new season, coming into a season that had the same cliffhanger as the book. But the thing that really I like about it is that it's all Lizzie. I mean, Lizzie drives it. It's all her point of view. And, you know, coming back after the break, after the hiatus between seasons, and you know, we were very lucky to get lots of, you know, accolades along the way. It was difficult to kind of settle down and say, okay, well, what, get back to the work of season two. And so I was thrilled at the way it came out, but also I was just, it was so fun to see Lizzie jump back into that suit after she just itching to get back and to be offered again. So I mean, I was so happy with the way it turned out, and also just, you know, watching it be transported by Lizzie. Now I know Lizzie well, and I know, you know, what she's like as a person, and I know what she's like as an actress, and still I'm blown away and swept away. You know, I really feel like she's feeling those things.
Yeah.
And even though I was on set and know that she started laughing right after we said cut and all that kind of stuff. But that's, I think it's Lizzie's performance and how focused it is on Lizzie really makes it my favorite.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned, I mean, obviously season one, you were able to produce a bit in a bubble, and then, you know, the Emmys and the accolades came after that. So there's a different feeling, I imagine, in going back to work and starting the pressure's on, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the first season of the show, although it was from a very famous book, a classic book, and there was a little bit of attention just because I was a boy running a clearly woman-centered, woman-voiced show, which, you know, is an issue. And so they caused a little bit of attention, but, you know, we were just slugging away in the dark, which is, you know, kind of the way you are first year on every show.
Yeah.
And when the second year came around, you know, you're trying to write and you have a big Emmy sitting in the middle of your keyboard and you're trying to type around it. You can't get to the L and the M and all those kind of letters because they're covered. Yeah. So what eventually you just have to do is go, okay, we're not going to do this. You know, that's a great way to write a bad show. And so you try to throw away the Emmy and just sit down and write. And that was a new experience for me. I've never kind of been on any kind of show that's gotten these kind of accolades, and certainly I haven't, you know, been lucky enough to get them. So you kind of are nervous about, okay, how the hell do I get past this and get back to doing what got me here? But luckily I had friends. I mean, I have, the community of writers in Los Angeles is, you know, wonderful and close and supportive, and big. And so you end up knowing a lot of people who have been through similar situations, and luckily you can call them up and sit down and have breakfast and say, okay, what the hell do you do?
Yeah.
You know, how do you write, you know, just write, you know, when you've got all of this last season, the future season, you know, don't ruin it, you know, kind of all hanging over your head. And I got some very good advice from people.
Yeah.
You know, kind of caring, thoughtful writer-to-writer advice. And, I think that's one of the nicest things, the things that you don't really see is the wider community of writers, actors, directors, producers that exists here. You know, we got a little bit more of a sense of it as the Me Too movement started and kind of saw what had been happening kind of right under our eyes to some of our colleagues. But you don't realize from the outside that those are the people we work with all the time. We switch around from show to show, but we're very much a community. And you have places to go for help and advice. And, you know, you hope you can expand that people are more comfortable coming forward with all sorts of things, not just professional questions.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously season two done now, so you can exhale. It clearly worked out, but there was, and I know you've been asked a lot about sort of the pressure of moving on from the book and was that, how liberating was that versus, again, sort of the pressure of, okay, we now we're moving on. Now we're, you know, creating new stories.
Well, it's a champagne problem, a Prosecco problem, to be moving on past your first season on the show.
Yeah.
But, you know, I made a lot of small and large alterations to the story in season one. Added big things, moved things around. Most of it is kind of, you know, wouldn't recognize it unless you're a very close reader of the book. But, you know, we took some things that were sentenced and made them into a whole episode, took some things that were a big part of the book and turned them into one sentence. We did a lot of that. And so those kind of changes kind of set me up for being comfortable following my own instincts on kind of dramatically what would happen in Gilead. And that was really supported by Margaret, you know, Margaret Atwood, yeah, who has been very supportive of the show, very, you know, comfortable, energetic, generous with her time. You know, she's a spectacular woman and a, you know, just a lovely friend and companion. She really is terrific. And she was, you know, very encouraging of us, you know, going on. But I really think that she set up such a foundational world that I never feel like we're moving beyond the book. I always feel like, yeah, we're just exploring aspects of a world that's Margaret's world, and also Margaret's tone, which is really the thing that I think makes the show, is that kind of Atwoodness, that very grounded, realistic, kind of medieval world with these modern voices kind of looking at it going, wow, this is really messed up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're sort of adding pages between the end of the book and the epilogue.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe we didn't go beyond the book. Maybe we're just covering those 200 years
right
between the beginning and the historical.
Yeah, events. Yeah. Well, two things about the first episode back in season two that sort of said to me, okay, like they were able to do this now in success is clearing This Woman's Work by Kate Bush, which is actually one of my favorite songs of all time. It's such a good song. It's such an emotional song. And, you know, I don't know how hard it is to get that song, but nonetheless, it felt like
it's
you were able
so
to.
It's not so hard to get, but it was hard to find a place that I felt like was, yeah, worth using it, because it's such an iconic song for me and so beautiful. And I've only seen it in one movie, which was, you know, She's Having
She's
a Baby.
She's Having a Baby, I was going to say.
And it was so moving in that movie,
yeah,
that I thought, well, I don't, you know, you don't want to mess it up.
Yeah.
So when we kind of, you know, and I don't really think about music before we put the sequence together, and then we started to think about music, and we tried a few things, and when I saw that, it was the most affecting. But I was also like, you know, am I being affected by the John Hughes movie, by the, you know,
right,
by She's Having a Baby, or Kate Bush's amazing voice and just the way the song was put together. I thought it ended up working perfectly, but it took me a little convincing because I was so attached to the song in general that you don't want to sully it with, like, okay, this isn't quite right. You know, we're just using it to make a horrible moment more horrible. Who wants to do that?
Yeah.
So it had to be worth it. I had to feel like it was worth it.
And the other thing was, I still love the story of how you guys convinced Major League Baseball to use the Red Sox to actually, like, depict that.
It was amazing. Most of it was Warren Littlefield, who's, mm-hmm, one of my partners on this, and Lizzie Moss, who is also one of my partners, an EP on this. And she's a huge Cubs fan and a Cubs booster, and you know, if she has any identifier in the world beyond actress, I think it would be Cubs fan. And, you know, Warren is connected to people in that world. He's connected to everybody, but also he knows the co-owner of the,
yeah,
Red Sox.
He knows Tom Werner. Yeah. They're old TV buddies. Yeah.
So I was positive they would say no, that they wouldn't let us use it, but they invited us to come look at Fenway. We went to look at it and see if we wanted to shoot there, and they were willing to kind of discuss shooting there. But the rights in Major League Baseball are super complicated because, you know, one person owns the right to the team, but they don't own but you've also got Major League Baseball, the entity, to sign off on using anything to do with the team. And then there's Fenway Park, which is festooned with advertisements, national ones and local ones, mm-hmm, and also stuff. And where do you even start with that? And without those, it isn't Fenway Park. I mean, the signs are kind of integral to the structure.
Yeah.
It was a process that we were constantly worried was going to fall through.
Yeah.
But in the end, Warren, you know, kind of shepherded it through the whole way. And then when we were trying to figure out how you clear the signs, how, you know, what you do about the signs in the baseball park. Because on the one hand, I think those people had signed deals with Major League Baseball and the Red Sox that you weren't allowed to show the stadium without showing their signs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but we certainly didn't want to make anybody, you know, kind of the sponsor of hanging in Gilead.
Right.
And so, so, you know, you're kind of going back and forth, and eventually kind of we decided, well, you know, they are, you know, we're not those – those signs certainly aren't saying those corporate.
And that's it for this edition of Turn It On. Join us again next week, and be sure to subscribe to Turn It On iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere you download podcasts. Also, head on over to IndieWire.com for your daily fix of TV news, analysis, and reviews. And while there, sign up for our daily TV newsletter. I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll turn it on again next time.
The moment even more Atwoody. Yeah. You know, to have those pictures from the old world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I asked Warren about it, and it sounded like his pitch to Tom Werner and the rest of the crew was perfect, which was the whole, what's more American than baseball, and what's more devastating than to show a world where that has been taken away, and what a perfect representation of how terrible this new world is, and it was
very smart, and also I think exactly what we're trying to do. I mean, Warren often, you know, I get in the weeds of how we're going to do the scene, and he's able to take a step back and articulate kind of what you're saying about the wider world. And I think that was, you know, we weren't being disingenuous. That was what we wanted to say, was the whole, we weren't saying, you know, Fenway was a terrible place and now it's still a terrible place. We were saying it used to be a lovely place and look what they've done to it, which makes it even the more terrible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so we're talking a lot about hope these days and the future. And obviously that's a tough, when watching Handmaids, it's oftentimes really tough to feel hopeful, but there are those glimmers. Mm-hmm. And do you feel like the as the show goes on, the pendulum can start to swing, or what is sort of your feeling about the balancing, bleakness with hope?
I feel like any episode that comes out with June alive at the end is incredibly hopeful. I mean, she's struggling to survive, and anytime she succeeds, that's just her existence at the end of an episode. So I find it inspiring, you know, her strength, her ability to keep her sanity and her sense of humor and her sense of self, and also to believe in things that seem impossible. I'm going to see my daughter again. I'm going to get out, all those kind of things. So I actually don't find it – I find it a very cruel, misogynistic, kind of, you know, spectacularly awful place, Gilead.
Oh, Gilead. I thought you were talking about right now.
No, Gilead.
Okay.
Gilead, I think, is an awful place. Yeah. But that just kind of proves more that her ability, June's ability to survive and also to push and change things just a little bit, makes me feel like, oh my gosh, well, our world hasn't fallen to that place yet. We still have a chance. And if we, you know, so it's giving you an object lesson. I think I have a different feeling about the show than most of the people watch. I mean, it's rough, definitely, but I feel like it's kind of a testament to June's strength as a woman.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, absolutely, absolutely. It's such a great character, and of course, Lizzie Moss, can't say enough amazing things about her.
And not only a great executive producer with me, but just one of the most lovely humans you ever want to meet. You know, so smart, such a pro. You know, tireless doesn't even begin to cover it, but just, you know, a pleasure to work with.
Yeah, that's always great to have the number one on the call sheet be someone like that, mm-hmm. because that sets the tone, right,
yes,
for the entire production.
And she very much does that, and everybody going down the call sheet also is you know, an advocate, an outward loud advocate for a certain kind of professionalism, a certain kind of attitude on the set, a pleasure, taking pleasure in their work. You don't feel anybody, no one ever feels like they're being dragged to work. Everybody kind of shows up, bouncing up and down, whether it's 3 a.m. and snowing or 105 degrees and bright sun. They, you know, they're all there. And they're very different in terms of their careers, very different in terms of their personalities and their approach to acting, and they get along beautifully because they are all really enjoying that everybody shows up ready to go, you know, and really puts their shoulder into the show.
So we're here in the production offices. What can you tell me about timetable-wise? Where are you guys at in terms of season three?
I finished work on season two about a month after we started season three. So I overlapped a little. So I was still working on season two.
Yeah.
You know, we're starting to write our first, you know, three episodes. We usually spend the first 2-3 weeks talking about overall stuff, and then it starts to coalesce into episodes, and we've gotten that. We have, you know, kind of an overall sense of the season, and, you know, usually when we talk about one season, we say, okay, and the next season will be. So we have kind of a sense of where this season ends and how that would kick us off into the next season.
Season, so we already think in season four as well.
And yeah, well, you have to, because otherwise I think you put yourself in jail. Mm-hmm. And also you inevitably make it an unsatisfying end and an unsatisfying beginning, because it's not supposed to be the end of one season, the beginning of the next. It's supposed to be the end of the series. So I always think about kind of the next, and you know, we've been very lucky in terms of, you know, Hulu support and MGM support. So I'm hoping we'll be able to come back for a season four. But right now, you know, we're just concentrating on what's June's journey through season three in a real kind of practical way. What does she want? How does she move along step by step? In a lot of ways, the storytelling on the show is quite simple, because the hurdles for and the challenges for June are so apparent and so great, and the stakes are so high that you never have to worry about, oh, why is she doing this? Why is she bothering? Why doesn't she just go to the mall? You know, it's like you don't have to ask those questions.
Right.
You know, she's put in a position where she's constantly making moves that have huge stakes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, Bruce, congratulations on the nominations.
So, I was surprised.
No, you weren't.
Oh,
come
always,
on.
Yeah. Have you met any writers? Of course.
That's right.
I mean,
Well, congrats on that.
Thank you.
It should be an interesting next couple of weeks. I know you got to do a lot of this banging the drums a little bit, but
it's a pleasure to do. I mean, the thing you're always happiest about is so many actors got nominated, women who just did spectacular work, 7 women acting nominations for the show,
yeah.
But also all the craft departments who they make this show. You know, it's a beautiful, well-made show, and they're the people who make it and make it beautiful.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I mean, the fact that you know, they're dealing with so many different time frames, and you know, I'm always fascinated by the flashbacks.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And because that's a little more the sci-fi element of it, I suppose, the like going back in time and how did this all happen?
A different now.
Yeah, yeah.
And makes my stomach hurt.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. Honestly, someone at the finale took a photo of the map of Gilead, which I'd never really seen. I don't know if that's been out there.
It's that was made by kind of the art department,
uh-huh,
off of one of the maps we had. And, you know, when you sit down and have those conversations generally about what it's going to be, and then you start talking, then they start making a specific map, you end up kind of getting into, you know, it would have taken the rest of our lives in academia to figure out exactly where, you know, is Omaha in or out, you know, those kind of questions. So we put together a map that was, you know, kind of generally what we thought, you know, Gilead. But Gilead is, you know, fluid. I mean,
yeah,
there's a lot of rebellion in Gilead. They're not friends with either of their neighbors, which is, you know, kind of unheard of in North America. You know, Mexico and Canada kind of hate them.
Yeah.
So all of those things make for a lot of rebellion along the – there's a nice round ring around the edge of Gilead.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a little concerned about Los Angeles. But
sorry, so who isn't?
Yeah. But I'm also just happy to know that Oprah is okay.
Oprah's fine.
Oprah is okay. So, well, Bruce, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this edition of My Favorite Episode. Join us again next time as we once again explore another guest pick. And be sure to subscribe to My Favorite Episode on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com for your daily fix of TV news, analysis, and reviews. I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you again next time.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.